terms of its overriding theme, where the passage is pushing us to look, and the connection that there is with the work of our Savior. So I'd like to encourage you this morning to join me in the book of Exodus and chapter 5. We have been studying this book over the last several weeks, and our series brings us here to Exodus chapter 5. And we will be considering all of this chapter and just barely into chapter 6 as well. And I want to warn you that as we go through the next several chapters of Exodus, we really are riding on a roller coaster. It has been a really encouraging time to consider God's patience in dealing with Moses about the role that God had given him to go and lead the people of Israel out. Moses finally, though a bit reluctantly it seems, takes the steps forward to go to Egypt, and he is now going to carry out the very first effort in pursuing his mission of engaging with Pharaoh and getting the people out of slavery, but things are not going to go very well. And initially, this is like we are at the top of a roller coaster with all of the encouragement that we saw last week in chapter 4, and now we are going to go down really fast, and it's going to be a bit disturbing. So how do we process this? How do we think about the fact that here's a guy who didn't want to do this in the first place? God almost had to twist his arm to be his servant for this calling. And he finally goes and sticks his neck out, and this is what happens. Well, what I want to say is that that has not been the experience of Moses only in the history of the Old Testament or the story of many, many servants of Jesus Christ. And I want to start today by reading you an account of somebody who went through something similar. Many of you would recognize the name John Payton, and he was a missionary of the 19th century who served the Lord in the New Hebrides Islands in the South Pacific, which was a part of the world that was filled with cannibals, and it was a great risk to his life that he went over there. The Lord spared him from so many other things that could have happened along the way of evangelizing, and used him greatly. He left an incredible legacy of ministry, and through his gospel preaching, Christ transformed scores of those savage natives and made them new creations. And yet there was an enormous price that this man had to pay. Here's one account about one incident in his ministry. And the author says that Payton and his wife arrived on the island of Tanna November 5, 1858, and Mary, his wife, was pregnant. The baby was born February 12, 1859, and these now are the words of Payton, quote, "Our island exile thrilled with joy, but the greatest of sorrows was treading hard upon the heels of that great joy." And the author describes that Mary had had repeated attacks of a kind of malaria fever, pneumonia, and other health struggles for about 2 weeks. And then Payton says, in a moment, altogether unexpectedly, she died on March the 3rd. "To crown my sorrows and complete my loneliness, the dear baby boy, whom we had named after her father, Peter Robert Robeson, was taken from me after 1 week's sickness on the 20th of March. Let those who have ever passed through any similar darkness as of midnight feel for me." Notice how he is longing for sympathy from a broken heart. "As for all others, it would be more than vain to try to paint my sorrows." And he went about, he had to dig the two graves for his family members with his own hands and buried them by the house that he had built. He goes on to say, "Stunned by that dreadful loss, In entering upon this field of labor to which the Lord had himself so evidently led me, my reason seemed for a time almost to give way. Being translated, I almost went crazy. The ever-merciful Lord sustained me, and that spot became my sacred and much-frequented shrine during all the following months and years when I labored on for the salvation of the savage islanders amidst difficulties, dangers, and deaths. But for Jesus and the fellowship he vouched to me there, I must have gone mad and died beside the lonely grave. Well, those are difficult words to read, but hopefully they give you some sense of the shock and the sorrow of our text today, because in chapter 4, we did see all those powerful lessons that Moses was learning that were encouraging him to move forward in his call, and there was all of this about God's sovereignty and how Moses needed to be faithful and how God was going to fulfill prophecy and gave these little tokens of his faithfulness. But when you cross into chapter 5, it's like all of that just comes crashing down, and all of the theology that chapter 4 taught us seems to be turned upside down. And our theme this morning is along those lines. I'd like to preach you today on overwhelming disappointment in the pursuit of God's call. Overwhelming disappointment in the pursuit of God's call. And as we work our way through this passage, we'll see that this disappointment and how people are interacting with it and how it affected Moses and the Israelites, the passage moves forward. It progresses in four movements. The first of them is the longest of them, and it's really the core of the issue of what happened here. It is in verses 1 to 19, and we're reading here about the oppression of God's enemies. That was the disappointment, that Pharaoh did not take well to the idea that the people of Israel should be let out. And in fact, things got way worse in their bondage before they got any better. The oppression of God's enemies. And it wasn't just that Moses goes there and Pharaoh says, well, you guys are at this lower status of society. You're like the dregs of the earth and you deserve to be in bondage or something. It really becomes a rejection of God himself that Pharaoh begins to oppress the people even more. In other words, it wasn't just the human level. This was a theological, a spiritual battle. Look with me at the first couple of verses. Afterward, Moses and Aaron went and said to Pharaoh, thus says Yahweh, the God of Israel, let my people go that they may hold a feast to me in the wilderness. But Pharaoh said, who is Yahweh that I should obey his voice and let Israel go? I do not know Yahweh, and moreover, I will not let Israel go. Moses presents this not on the horizontal level only, and the great need the people had of their bondage being taken away, but this is fundamentally a matter of which God is going to be worshipped and which God is going to be honored. And Pharaoh understands it. Pharaoh gets it that this is not just about people, it's about God. He understands that this is not about ethnology, but about theology. Which God is worthy of his worship, and which God is worthy of his submission. And that would have been a very personal matter to Pharaoh, not only because he already was committed to other objects of worship, but because in the Egyptian way of thinking, even the pharaohs were considered to be gods. And so it was a very personal thing for him to be challenged now with some other god that he'd never heard of, that he was supposedly bound to obey. And the way that he answers is so consistent with what we've been seeing about the theme of Exodus as a whole. He says, who is Yahweh? I do not know Yahweh. And hopefully, if you don't remember anything else about these other sermons, you would be able to say something about what is the basic theme of Exodus, that the message of the book as a whole. I've been pointing out in different ways that it's not just about getting the people of Israel out. It is not just about them now becoming a formal nation with a law. It is not just about them having this tabernacle where they can access God, but it's about, through all that, actually them knowing God experientially. Exodus is fundamentally a book about the experiential knowledge of God. And even though that is mostly about the Israelites coming to know God through those experiences, by the time this is over, even Pharaoh is going to have a pretty decent knowledge of God experientially. That's going to become clear all the way at the bitter end of this. And even though that knowledge didn't save him, he still had come to know a huge amount by experience of who this God Yahweh is. In fact, after the destruction of all the plagues, here is how the Lord describes what would happen when it finally came to the Red Sea. I'm reading here from chapter 14, verses 17 and 18. God says, "And I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians, so that they shall go in after them. And I will get glory over Pharaoh and all his host, his chariots and his horsemen." And now it doesn't say the Israelites, it says the Egyptians shall know that I am Yahweh when I have gotten glory over Pharaoh, his chariots, and his horsemen. And basically that is the answer to the challenge that Moses presents in the verses in chapter 5. He says, "Who is Yahweh that I should obey him? I don't know Yahweh." And God comes at the end and says, "You know Yahweh now. You know him through all of this judgment that he's inflicted on your people, including the final straw of wiping out your firstborn and then destroying your forces in the Red Sea." Pharaoh's experiential knowledge had to do with knowing Yahweh, sadly, through judgment. And yet even he, at this early stage, understands a principle that sometimes we struggle to get our minds around and really accept. He understands that if you truly accept and know God, whether his name is Yahweh or whatever, the concept of somebody being a God and being rightly related to that God, he says, "Who is Yahweh that I should obey him?" In other words, to truly know Yahweh in the fullness of who he is and really appreciate his character necessitates that you would submit to him. You can't know Yahweh and just say, "Well, that's nice. I'm so glad that you all worship this God, you know, kind of enjoy that, and that's your right, and I hope it goes well for you." You can't be casual like that when you're talking about the one true and living God. If he is Yahweh and everything he says he is, the only option that you have is to submit yourself to him. He got that, even though it would actually take the people of Israel a very long time to get that, because they confessed Yahweh, they accepted him as their God, but you have story after story where they did not appreciate the necessity of obedience if you're going to claim Yahweh as your God. And that's how this story starts. The oppression begins with Pharaoh just out of hand dismissing the God of the Israelites. And then as we move on, he rebuffs the actual request they make as they come back with an appeal. "Then they said," verse 3, "the God of the Hebrews has met with us. Please, let us go a 3 days journey into the wilderness that we may sacrifice to Yahweh our God, lest he fall upon us with pestilence or with sword." But the king of Egypt said to them, "Moses and Aaron, why do you take the people away from their work? Get back to your burdens." And I want us to note a couple of things about the statement that Moses and Aaron make here. First of all, their request is for a 3 days journey to go into the wilderness and hold special worship sacrifices to the Lord. And that goes back to the orders that God gave Moses in chapter 3, 18, where he told them what he was supposed to say, and it included the idea of a 3 days journey for sacrifice. This would really not have been an unusual thing for Pharaoh to understand, because we have Egyptian records that indicate that it was common for even slaves to have a certain amount of rites honored where they were given time off for the worship of their gods. And yet, as we look at this, it still seems a bit odd because we know that God's intent is for them to get out of there altogether, and yet he presents it as though, well, this is just a three-day trip for a, you know, special Bible conference or whatever, implying that maybe they would come back. And as commentators have wrestled with that, there are different proposals as to what is going on here and how to understand that. God isn't deceiving, but how does this make sense? The explanation that I find most compelling is that this was an initial statement that the Lord put out there to just kind of get this process going, that it became clear over time in interacting with Pharaoh that the idea ultimately was to get him out of there for good, but this was an initial test of the inclinations of Pharaoh and how he would respond to even this one little request at the beginning, which was not anywhere near the whole package or the plan. And it was a part of the process of the Lord hardening Pharaoh's heart, like we talked about last week. That this takes place as the Lord is challenging him with this little idea, and he resists that, and the more and more the pressure mounts, the harder and harder his heart gets. That is the instrument that God used to harden his heart from the very beginning. Like, this is the first interaction. This man is already so stubborn that he won't give them even a few days off. And more pressure that Yahweh puts on them, the harder and harder he becomes. Now, another thing that Moses and Aaron say is, let us do this, lest God fall on us with pestilence or with the sword. That one's a bit of a surprise. You may have wondered about that, because in God's instructions in chapter 3, there is no precedent for Moses needing to say that. And it seems to be here that under his own kind of pressure that Moses was feeling, he was making this desperate plea, and as a way of emphasizing just how badly they wanted to get out of there and to appeal for more mercy, he adds this concept that if they don't do it, God's going to strike them with pestilence and the sword. Well, actually, over time, God is going to strike the Egyptians with pestilence and the sword for refusing to go. And so why would Moses throw this in? There are actually some other differences, more minor than this, but there are some other differences between what God told Moses to say and what Moses actually did. One of those is that in the instructions in chapter 3, the Lord said it should be Moses and Aaron and the elders to go to Pharaoh as kind of a united front of making this request, and there is no mention here of the elders being involved in that process. And there are some who have suggested that by not following God's instructions to the letter and by adding things that were extreme at this early point, lest he fall on us with pestilence or with the sword, Moses is actually making things harder for himself as he makes it more dramatic than it should have been. And you can consider that, but even if Moses did overstate the case or wasn't careful enough about his approach, it just serves to highlight even more the theme that runs through all these passages about the sovereignty of God. That even the foolishness of his own people, their lack of carefulness, their misstated or misspoken words, even their mistakes along the way, end up contributing to the accomplishment of God's will. And God just kind of weaves all that into the whole process of working judgment in the life of Pharaoh. At any rate, as Pharaoh gets that appeal, he moves from denying the time off to commanding them to get back to work. Even Moses and Aaron, who weren't slaves, it sounds like they're being told to get out of here and go make some bricks. And then he makes the matter even worse as we come to verses 5 to 13. And at this point, he is going to remove the assistance that up to this point the slaves had had in the provision of straw for the bricks that they were making. And so verse 5, Pharaoh said, "Behold, the people of the land are now many, and you make them rest from their burdens." So he's taking the tack that the reason these people are wanting to be delivered and the reason why Moses and Aaron feel the liberty to come into the court of Pharaoh and make this kind of request is that their lives are too easy. You got too much time on your hands. Maybe you find yourself sometimes telling your kids that, and they end up in trouble because they are idle. And Pharaoh, I don't know, maybe he's thinking about his own childhood, but that's the line he takes here. Your problem is you don't have enough to do. That's why you get all these crazy ideas. And look at what he says. He commanded the taskmasters of the people and their foremen, "You shall no longer give the people straw to make bricks as in the past. Let them go and gather straw for themselves. But the number of the bricks that they made in the past, you shall impose on them. You shall by no means reduce it, for they are idle. Therefore they cry, 'Let us go and offer sacrifices to our God.' Let heavier work be laid on the men, that they may labor at it and pay no regard to lying words." So the taskmasters and the foremen of the people went out and said to the people, "Thus says Pharaoh, I will not give you straw. Go and get your straw yourselves wherever you can find it, but your work will not be reduced in the least." So the people were scattered throughout all the land of Egypt to gather stubble for straw. The taskmasters were urgent, saying, "Complete your work, your daily task each day, as when there was straw." And as happens so often in cases of the persecution of God's people, Pharaoh grounds his decree in a false accusation and claims that the issue is the people are lazy. And so he makes them go out and get their own straw instead of having, evidently, the Egyptian helpers come alongside and provide that material for them. That's a little hard for us to relate, this whole business about straw and bricks and how does that work, because our construction ideas today are a lot different. But you are basically talking about bricks that are made out of mud, that whether because of the heat or because of the rain could end up crumbling apart. And so the straw was mixed in there with it as a way of reinforcing the bricks a little bit and helping the mud to stick together, kind of like today we would use rebar in concrete to strengthen and to help kind of join it all together. The question is, where would they get the straw? And it was not a very happy undertaking. You're talking about this material being provided by the leftovers of stalks that had already been harvested or from whatever random plant material that the people could find in some field out there. And it is back-breaking work of having to scour these fields and bend over and look for these little pieces of straw and collect it all up and then transport it to the kiln on top of the already exhausting work of making the bricks themselves. And, of course, all of this was going on under the blazing heat of the Middle Eastern sun. Does anybody's back hurt this morning? Mine kind of does. We have been doing some remodeling at our house that over the last few weeks has literally involved moving everything out of every room except for one bathroom. And it's just like this musical furniture, musical everything, just shifting it around from room to room while the floors are redone and some other work is taking place. And yesterday I was, that included my books, and yesterday I started the process of putting all of that back. And after all this lifting and so forth, you know, anytime I see some little scrap of something on the floor, I'd have to bend down just to pick up whatever. It doesn't have to be heavy. It's just killing me back here in the lower back because of all of this other work that I had been doing. You know what that is like. And you can imagine this sort of thing happening out in the heat day after day after day. And it's all about building these little bricks to construct these pyramids and other structures that are all about honoring the Egyptian pharaoh and even acknowledging the Egyptian gods. A terrible experience that these people had to suffer. And Pharaoh insisted on the same quota of bricks every day. Nothing changed. A totally unreasonable demand that was designed to just crush these people and humiliate them and break down their resistance. And all of this is presented against the backdrop of that original theological conflict. You may remember verse 1 began this way. This is how it all started. They go to the court and they say, "Thus says the Lord, let my people go." And look at verse 10. The taskmasters, the employees, the managers under Pharaoh, they go to the people and they say, "No, forget about what thus says Yahweh, thus says Pharaoh. There's not going to be any straw. You're going to have to do that too." This is a direct rebuttal of thus says Yahweh. He says, "No, my word is the one that counts here. Thus says Pharaoh. This is the way it's going to be." And under those circumstances, the people cannot exactly go to HR and demand better conditions. Nor can they band together in a union and go on strike. And yet they do what they can. And it took courage on the part of these men who take the next step. And interestingly, it wasn't Moses and Aaron. It was some of those foremen who were like middle managers that had been appointed by Pharaoh or his overseers to manage the work of their own people. Now they get up the courage to go directly to Pharaoh themselves. And this brings us to the last part of their oppression as it is described in verses 14 to 20. And at this point, Pharaoh's heart is so hard that there's just this utter refusal to show mercy. Verse 14. "And the foremen of the people of Israel, whom Pharaoh's taskmasters had set over them, were beaten and were asked, 'Why have you not done all your task of making bricks today and yesterday as in the past?' Then the foremen of the people of Israel came and cried to Pharaoh, 'Why do you treat your servants like this? No straw is given to your servants, yet they say to us, make bricks. And behold, your servants are beaten, but the fault is in your own people.' But he said," see, they thought maybe there was a misunderstanding, or maybe we could just make an appeal and explain to him the details of what's happening. Actually, he's not on their side. "You are idle. You are idle," he repeats it. "That is why you say, 'Let us go and sacrifice to the Lord.' Go now and work. No straw will be given to you, but you must still deliver the same number of bricks." The foremen of the people of Israel saw that they were in trouble when they said, "You shall by no means reduce your number of bricks, your daily task each day." They were in trouble. I guess so. In the face of what seems to be a very rational argument, this man simply doubles down on his false accusation of laziness. There is no mercy. There is only more hardness and more harshness. And that part of the text ends on a note of despair. Like there's no solution in sight. This is a hopeless situation. What do we have that we could do to argue against the Pharaoh? Hopeless, despairing. Maybe that is sometimes the way you feel even when you know you are doing the will of God, just like Moses and these people were. And how often have you tried to argue with the Lord or just kind of frustrated within yourself and you say, God, I'm just trying to serve you. This wasn't my idea in the first place. I thought I was just trying to be faithful here. And this happens? What's up with that? This doesn't make any sense. Circumstances can look so out of control and so contrary to what you expect that you find yourself throwing your hands up in the air and crying out like these people did, I am in such trouble, there is no rescue in sight, and I have no idea what I'm going to do next. I cannot survive this. Now, when you're struggling that way, you might also be tempted to take it out on other people. And especially the people who seem to be most responsible for having gotten you into this mess in the first place. Like the people that hired you, or that called you to that ministry, or someone that the Lord used to move you in that direction. And that's what's going to happen next, in the next couple of verses. And so we're going to move from the oppression of God's enemies. I mean, that was bad enough in terms of the pressure of this for Moses. We're going to move from that to, secondly, the anger of God's own people. The anger of God's people. Verse 20. They met Moses and Aaron, who were waiting for them as they came out from Pharaoh. Why Moses and Aaron didn't go in the first place, I don't know. And they said to them, Yahweh, look on you and judge, because you have made us stink in the sight of Pharaoh and his servants, and have put a sword in their hand to kill us. Strong words. In fact, they are calling down the judgment of God when they say on Moses, when they say, may the Lord look on you and judge. Probably all of us know the weight of shame that comes over us when we know that people are disappointed in us. It could be your boss at work when you have failed at some task, and he may not say the words, but you can kind of read it in his eyes, like he's saying, dude, you had one job and you blew it. Or husbands, it could be your wife and your children when you have done something foolish that has a negative impact on them. And maybe it's something as simple as poor planning that messes up a long-awaited vacation. Or maybe it's a financial disaster that is owing to your poor management. And if you've ever been in a situation like that and you know what it feels like for somebody to be staring at you and you have no way out of it and you have to admit, I blew it. Maybe that gives you a little taste of what Moses must have felt in this situation. Remember that earlier he had himself tried many years before. He had tried and failed to deliver his fellow Israelites. And the Israelites doubted him then. Then he didn't want to come to do this job, and the Lord really had to work with him to get him to be willing to do that. And now it looks like all that's happening all over again. Another failure. And everybody's doubting me, like, who are you, and who do you think you are, and look at the mess you've gotten us into. And yet now the stakes are so much higher. He hasn't only not delivered them, but he has made their lives immensely worse. And the way that they word it here, remember it says, you've put a sword in their hands to kill us. They assume that before much longer, people are actually going to start to die because of all of this overwork, making bricks with no straw. Well, those kinds of burdens and those kinds of feelings are the kinds of things that all of us probably at some point have to carry in life, and especially those who have been called to leadership. And it's not just the burden of leading people, but it is the added burden of when they end up suffering as a result of your decisions. That is a risk that you take when you sign up to be a leader. And I imagine it's a good reason that many people don't want to be leaders. They don't want to fail. They don't want to let people down. They don't want to incur the wrath of disappointed followers. And there's also the pressure now of figuring out what in the world to do to fix this problem. He's got all these eyes glaring at him and demanding a resolution. You got us into this bind. Now you need to get us out of here. And that added to Moses' sense of frustration and pressure. As you and I strive to serve the Lord in our own callings, as I read this story and so many others like it, what I take away is that I need to anticipate that this kind of thing is going to happen. Even for as great a leader as somebody might be, even for as wonderful a strategy as they might have, some degree of failure and frustration and people being dissatisfied with your leadership is unavoidable. Even if we have done a perfect job in planning and execution, there are always going to be things that do not go like we expect. And in this passage, we're seeing that this was all of God. On the human level, it looks like a mistake and like Moses blew it as a leader, but it really wasn't Moses' fault. You know, maybe he didn't word his statement to Pharaoh just right, but in essence, he was following God's will. And that made it all the more frustrating because the issue now isn't just that Moses as a leader has failed, but actually it looks like the Lord himself has failed. That's what really makes this painful. So now what is Moses going to do? And that brings us to the third movement in our text in verses 22 and 23, which I'm calling the confusion of God's servant. The confusion of God's servant. Verse 22, then Moses turned to the Lord and said, O Lord, why have you done evil to this people? Why did you ever send me? For since I came to Pharaoh to speak in your name, he has done evil to this people, and you have not delivered your people at all. Now, as you look at that, I think we can rightly object to some of the things that Moses is saying. It is language that blames God emphatically with the assumption that God, being sovereign, has somehow made a mistake or has not followed through on his word. More significantly, I think what he says there reflects just an almost inexplicable forgetfulness that we might even call unbelief. Because none of this should have been a surprise to him. Right in his calling, the Lord said in chapter 3, verse 19, explicitly, I know that the king of Egypt will not let you go unless compelled by a mighty hand. God told him this is not going to be easy. There's going to be pushback. There's going to be resistance. I'm going to harden his heart. There's going to be a big process here before it's all over. So in that sense, you could almost say that what happened in this chapter is a fulfillment of prophecy, just like some of the other things were. This should not have been a surprise to Moses that initially things were so difficult. It's like the Lord had already scripted all this out ahead of time. So we can sort of criticize Moses on that point. But for whatever unbelief or wrong perception or bad attitude that he might have had, we at least have to recognize this positively as to what we read there from Moses, that he is taking his frustrations and his burdens directly to the Lord. He is not running away from his calling. He is not abandoning Yahweh. He is going to the only one who can do anything about these overwhelming problems. Even in the midst of his confusion and doubt, he is still demonstrating a bedrock of faith in Yahweh as the sovereign God and as the God of the covenant. Notice the questions. Why have you done evil or brought disaster on this people? Why did you ever send me? He doesn't say, why did Pharaoh gain the upper hand? He says, no, Lord, you did this. You talk about a robust understanding of the sovereignty of God. Pharaoh is to blame. But Moses says, you did this, and Moses is right. That is actually a statement of faith. And then when he talks a little bit further, he says, you have not delivered your people at all. As if to say, God, this isn't my problem ultimately. This is your people. And you're committed to them, and you've made promises to them, and you're going to have to do something about it. The prayer itself gives indication that he is hanging on to the Lord. And this is the same kind of prayer that you find in so many of the lament psalms in the Psalter. You see it as well in the tortured prayers of Job. There is profound frustration with God. There is anguish before him. There is brutal honesty. There is a questioning of God's decisions. And there is even some dubious language. But these prayers are still prayers. They are the cries of a heart that continues to believe that God can deliver and that he is the only deliverer. And in that regard, I believe that Moses' prayer becomes a model for us. In fact, throughout the Pentateuch, we're going to see multiple examples of prayers like this coming from his lips and plenty of times when he is interceding in the most excruciating of circumstances. And that's how the chapter ends, with this desperate cry. Now, that is the end of the chapter in English, but thankfully, the editors of the Hebrew Bible, and I had not noticed this before, but the editors of the Hebrew Bible who marked up the different sections of the Scriptures in other ways, they actually included chapter 6, verse 1 as a part of this story. And that is so helpful because I didn't really want to end in chapter 5 and verse 23. And so after all of that, we come finally to the assurance of God's promise. Or you could say the reassurance of God's promise, because he had said these kinds of things before. But the Lord said to Moses, now you shall see what I will do to Pharaoh. For with a strong hand he will send them out, and with a strong hand he will drive them out of his land. Notice even the way the statement is introduced, but the Lord said. And I thought this is like those famous but God statements of the New Testament. And I'm not going to develop this because the rest of the chapter, chapter 6, develops it. We'll look at it, Lord willing, next time. But suffice it to say that all this crying out that Moses did, the Lord did answer him. And notice the Lord doesn't say, man, you really got a bad attitude. What's your problem? Like, we just had this conversation a chapter ago. Why are you still asking me these questions? The Lord does not rebuke him. He just assures him that the time is quickly approaching when he's going to step in and work to reverse everything that has happened in chapter 5. At the moment, Pharaoh's strong hand is pressing down on Israel. But eventually, that same strong hand is going to shove them out of Egypt. It won't happen right away. There is still a period of waiting and suffering and confusion to come. But God is going to deliver his people from their bondage. He's committed to that, and he is more than capable of that. And in the meantime, what Moses needs to do is simply to trust, and flowing from faith, to pursue God's call despite whatever setbacks. And folks, that is a good way to summarize the point of this passage for our own lives today, particularly when we find ourselves confused as our efforts to serve God don't pan out like we had thought. This is a call to trust the God that we're serving and to wait on him to act and to keep pursuing that call, even at times when it doesn't make a lot of sense. And this is not the only time in Scripture that we see this happening. There is a pattern that runs like this throughout the Bible. Abraham did not see the promise of a child fulfilled right away. There were a lot of twists and turns and disappointments before the fulfillment came. And you could say the same for so many of God's servants. Think about this little list of names. Joseph, Naomi, David, Elijah, Hezekiah, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Peter, Paul, John. Amazing promises God made to them, but enormous suffering along the path to the fulfillment of the promise. And why should you and I think that our lives should be any different? In fact, all these people are functioning like Hebrews 11 tells us, that they are that great cloud of witnesses who are testifying to the faithfulness of God through these stories and to the value of simple faith. And so, brothers and sisters, let us keep believing in the face of whatever disappointments, and let us press forward in doing what our God has called us to do in this generation. And I mentioned John Payton. Here is another thing he said about the death of his wife. I felt her loss beyond all conception or description in that dark land. It was very difficult to be resigned, left alone, and in sorrowful circumstances. But feeling, listen to this, overwhelmed with sorrow, but feeling immovably assured that my God and Father was too wise and too loving to err in anything that he does or permits. So I looked up to the Lord for help and struggled on in his work. You probably feel like that most days. Doesn't make any sense, but I'm looking to the Lord for help, and I'm struggling on to do this day what he's called me to do. This is what Payton did. This is what Moses did. But to come to the Lord's table, I want to point out that the greatest example of this pattern is the one whose work we are celebrating. He was the one who cried out in anguish from the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? Sounds like the end of Exodus 5. And it's true that he knew the answer to that question. But we don't want to get there so fast that somehow it makes light of his suffering or like this was no big deal for Jesus. It was deep and profound suffering. From the human standpoint, everything seemed loss when this man was hanging on the cross. And yet that wasn't the end of it, just like this isn't the end for Moses. Through the resurrection, Jesus went on to experience the rest of Psalm 22. I will tell of your name to my brothers. In the midst of the congregation, I will praise you. You who fear the Lord, praise him. All you offspring of Jacob, glorify him and stand in awe of him, all you offspring of Israel, for he has not despised or abhorred the affliction of the afflicted, and he has not hidden his face from him, but has heard when he cried to him. And may God give us grace to have that kind of faith and to experience in God's time his deliverance. You think about Psalm 22 as we reflect now on the death of Christ, the genuineness of his sufferings, as well as the victory in the end. I'd like to ask our men to come forward.